UFOs? Are they aliens? Government secret projects? The imaginings of disturbed individuals? Or just outright hoaxes? We're here to find out. Welcome to Jim Harold's UFO Encounters.
Welcome to UFO Encounters. I am Jim Harold. So glad to be with you once again. And today we're going to have an interesting discussion because we have someone who has taken the UFO subject, the UAP subject, to use the en vogue terminology, and looked at it over the large scope of time. And I really appreciate that. As I was telling him earlier before we hit record, sometimes I feel that we just look at UFOs from Roswell onward, and they go far, far before that. I'm talking about John Michael Greer. He is the author of the new book, The UFO Book, A Chronological Journey from Crop Circles to Roswell. And he's a great background. He was born in the gritty Navy town of Bremerton, Washington, and raised in the South Seattle suburbs. He says he began writing about as soon as he could hold a pencil. He lives in Maryland with his spouse, Sarah, serves as presiding officer in the Ancient Order of Druids in America. That's a Druid order founded in 1912, and writes in a half a dozen nonfiction fields, nearly all of them focused on the revival of forgotten ideas, insights, and traditions of practice from the rubbish heap of history, he says. He also runs the unexplained phenomena blog Echo Sophia, which receives over 150,000 visitors a month. And we're so glad to have him with us. John Michael Greer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So when you think about that kind of background, that doesn't scream UFOs to me. How did you get interested in this subject, and how long have you been interested in this subject?
Well, growing up in suburbia, in the 1960s and early 1970s, let's just say it was insanely boring. Everybody around me was convinced that this is the life, this is wonderful. I was going, there's got to be more to life than this. And so I was, you know, from like the age of six on, I was a complete sucker for anything that promised to show me that the world was less one-dimensionally tepid than what everyone, you know, what the schools and the media and my parents insisted it had to be. I was into, you rarely heard the term cryptozoology back in those days, but mm-hmm. I was into stories about Bigfoot. I was into stories about flying saucers, as we said back then. I was into anything strange. And I had a long time I had retained my interest in the UFO phenomenon. Later on in the 1970s, in my teen years, I got fairly deeply into it. I was very strongly influenced by John Keel and Jacques Vallée, who were at that time exploring some of the spookier aspects of the phenomenon. And that kind of, you know, other things more or less took precedence, but I always kept an interest in it. And then twice now I have had publishers approach me and say, we want you to do something on the UFO subject. And so my first book on the subject, The UFO Chronicles, was out originally. The original edition of that came out in 2009. And now this new one, I was really pleased by Union Square, this publisher, because they like doing that historical thing, the chronological approach. And they simply wanted to give us 100 really fascinating UFO sightings.
Huh. Interesting.
They see, this is the kind of thing they like to do. Instead of really focusing on theories or focusing on one particular part of the phenomenon, they like doing these broad overview books. And of course, their production values are good. And I thought, you know, there really needs to be that, because, as you said, so many of the books we have on the UFO phenomenon focus on the 1947 flap onwards.
Right.
You know, if it's before Kenneth Arnold, nobody knows it exists. And the other thing that they noted, and I was aware of it also, is that nearly everything fixates on sightings from the United States.
That's true.
If you ask people, you ask people as well in the American UFO scene, or UAP scene in this case, name some UFO sightings, the chance that they will mention anything outside the U.S. borders is fairly low. And yet, some of the most fascinating sightings ever have taken place in all over the world.
Right.
Africa has a lot of interesting sightings. Australia has a lot of them. You choose a continent. The Russians have had UFO sightings going on for centuries. And so I wanted to give a more complete view, something that covered the territory both in space and in time, so that and without going out of my way to suggest, you know, potential theories as to what the phenomenon is or any of that, just here is what people have seen in all these different places and all these different times. Make up your own mind.
I like that. I like that approach. That's similar to what we do with our campfire show that mm-hmm. we've been doing for, well, now it's 16 years. People come on and tell their experiences, whether it's ghost stories, whether it's UFOs, and we don't say, well, you know, we don't really try to put it in a certain peg. We just said, these are the experiences. I love that approach.
Yeah, so, here is what people saw. That's really important. That's got to be the starting point. Go on.
Absolutely. So when we say it goes way back, how far back do you go in this book?
Okay, I did. It literally goes as far back as we have written records. Okay, it goes back to the beginning of human literacy and probably before. There are things that show up in Stone Age cliff paintings that look unnervingly like things that people see in the sky now. So, and there are, of course, plenty of details in old myths and legends that sound weirdly like, you know, the latest stuff that you heard from, you know, this abductee or that experiencer of a sighting. So, you know, this is not a new thing. This is something that may be as old as our species, that may be older.
Did you find that there was an evolution of types? For example, I know, you know, in the 50s and things, there was the blonde-haired, blue-eyed George Adamski mm-hmm. contactees, and now, of mm-hmm. course, it's the alien grays that are all the rage. Did you find, but over the longer period of history, did you find more of an evolution, or kind of like you spoke to there, some commonalities, or was it just a mixed bag?
There's a lot of common ground, and interesting, the two types that you mentioned appear in a variety of contexts going back a very long ways. Jacques Vallée, in to my mind, is one of the best books on UFOs yet, Passport to Magonia.
Yes.
He talks about how UFO sightings now copy many of the patterns of what were identified back in the Middle Ages as encounters with fairies and elves and goblins. And if you look at a gray and think of the goblins of folklore who are little and have big heads and big eyes and scurry around, and then you look at the blondes that we hear about nowadays, and you look at the Irish stories of the Tuatha De Danann, who were tall and blonde and handsome or beautiful, as the case may be, and looked very humanoid. There's a lot of similarity there. There's an enormous amount of similarity there. And so it doesn't appear to have been an evolution. More, things come and go for whatever reason. People encounter certain things, and they encounter the same kind of things if you sort of average it out over the centuries.
Interesting. So I'm looking at the table of contents here, and in mm-hmm. one I've got to ask you about because it just caught my eye from 1678, The Mowing Devil. What in the world is The Mowing Devil? I never heard of that one.
The Mowing Devil is one of the very first documented crop circle phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, they put it in the context of the time. You know, this we're talking, let me see if I can find it in the book here.
Well, it's 1678, according to the...
1678, so let me find the page. 1678, so there we are, page 17. Let's find us a Mowing Devil. There's the Mowing Devil, yeah. Basically, there was a lot of folklore about this remarkable event which caused, they saw what looked like flame rising from an oak field, and the next morning, the oats had been mowed, as in cut down as though with a scythe, with supernatural neatness. Huh. Now, of course, this was put in context as, well, yes, there was a devil. The devil was involved. Because this is 1678, okay? This is a period when that kind of very traditionalist Christianity was all the rage. And so that's how they interpret it. But what we have here is a nicely documented, because, it, of course, the printing press was in existence. The pamphlet press in those days was what the internet is now. It's basically the place where you put up something, you get information out there, and people would run out to the bookstalls and get the latest news the way they log onto websites now. And so we have copies of this pamphlet dating back from 1678, describing a classic crop circle.
That's fantastic. I love that. And you spoke to this earlier when you talked about Ireland and things. The things like the fairies and so forth.
Yeah.
What all these different things that people have, or demons, you know, exactly. All these things.
Is it a devil?
Yeah.
Is it a spirit? Is it an elf? Is it an alien? Each age sort of puts its own gloss on its own theory about what is real and what can exist on a phenomenon that may have entirely different forms, possibly forms that we as human beings may not even be able to understand fully.
Yeah, great point. Another one that is really frightening, because this is something that impacts us all, because it could literally impact us all, the Tunguska event. And I remember I found out about that one on, the one for people of my age. I was just maybe a few years older than you, younger than you, excuse me, In Search Of, with Leonard Nimoy.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I watched that. I watched that passionately back
yes,
in the day.
Yes, me too. I think so many of us did, the Gen Xers and so forth. So, exactly. But anyway, that's where I found out about it. But this is amazing. Tell people about that if they're not familiar, because it's amazing and yet it's terrifying too. Because
it's terrifying. It is very terrifying because we don't know what caused it. What we know is that something came streaking out of the sky in 1908, and let me make sure I have the details right here. Crash. Yeah, 1908. June 30th, 1908, in the morning, all of a sudden something comes shrieking down out of the sky and blows up over an isolated river valley in Siberia. And it was a tremendous explosion. 800,000 acres of timber were incinerated. 500 reindeer who were near Groundsville were roasted alive where they stood. Windows were shattered 120 miles away. They detected the shock wave in London on barometers. It circled the globe twice. Something very large blew up. Current estimates are between 12 and 30 megatons, which is a big hydrogen bomb. There are, of course, many suggestions. Interestingly, the scientists have not tried to claim that it didn't happen. I have to say that's refreshing. I mean, usually the argument for mainstream science is if the cause isn't known, the effect didn't happen, which is logically garbage, but they're very fond of it. But there was no crater. So whatever happened, it blew up in the air. There are theories that it was a comet, but, by 1908, there were a lot of observatories searching the skies. Nobody saw the comet on its way in. Was it probably not a meteor, because it didn't leave any meteor fragments? It didn't leave a crater the way meteors. If you've ever been to a meteor crater down in Arizona, it's a pretty large thing. It's kind of hard to miss. So the theory that UFO researchers have been suggesting for quite some time now is that may have been the end of an alien spacecraft. That there may have been because there was anomalous amounts of radiation. Russian researchers in an expedition in 1959 and 1960 found unusually high levels of mutations in plants and animals in the area, and a lot of radioactive cesium in tree rings for that year. So the suggestion is that a nuclear-powered spacecraft from someplace else got in desperate trouble and blew up.
Interesting.
Now, did that happen? I have no idea. Certainly, though, something blew up, and thank heavens it blew up in an isolated area where the only casualties were reindeer.
I mean, this was a large area. So translate that to now if it had happened over any major metropolitan area.
Yeah, I mean, imagine something like that hitting someplace on the east coast of the United States or in Europe. Again, it's the force of a large nuclear bomb.
Yeah. Yeah, frightening.
Like 100 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb, it would have killed, quite possibly millions of people, and left total devastation across many miles. So just that this thing could happen suddenly, without warning, and with all that, with that enormous destructive force, it's spooky.
Another thing, really, from a few years before in the 1890s, that was really interesting. We've done full shows on this. The whole airship flap and people.
That is totally fascinating.
Yes.
Yeah, people. Now, here's the weird thing. Okay, 1896, 1897. No inventor had come up with an airship that really worked in those days. People were working hard on it. People all over in probably a dozen different countries were putting huge amounts of money into it. That's what, Count Zeppelin, the guy after whom Zeppelins were named. Count Zeppelin was hard at work, and he ended up some years later coming up with that. There were airship, the U.S. had its airship program, Britain had its airship program, France and so on and so forth, the Japanese, the Brazilians, everybody was working on it. But in 1896, nobody had figured out how to do it yet. There were some problems in aerial navigation that nobody worked out. And yet all of a sudden people start seeing these things.
Yeah.
What on earth was going on? Was there some kind of secret airship program? Or was there something else that was being mistaken for an airship? Or was there something else that was disguising itself as an airship? Or what? It's a marvelous mystery. I'm really glad that it's received as much attention recently as it has, simply because it really helps put it's like the ghost rockets of a few years later. It puts the UFO experience, the post-Roswell experience, it puts that into context. And we say, okay, there are a lot of weird things in the heavens. People see these things. I also like to recommend, and I'll toss this out to the listeners, if anybody has not yet read the books of Charles Fort.
Oh, yes.
Get out there and do that. It will rattle your view of reality, good and proper, but it will also give you an idea of just how many weird things in the sky people have been seeing.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm repeating myself, but everybody thinks all of this anomalous stuff started with the paranormal TV shows and all those things, which really annoys me.
Which is simply not true.
It's not true. And another thing that is another pet peeve of mine, my first show, which continues to this day, this month will be the 20th anniversary recording show, July. But when I said paranormal, I didn't mean just ghosts. And that's the thing now. Paranormal, you do a show on ghosts. Yeah, and UFOs and cryptids and just high strangeness and all this stuff to me. So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox, but that's one of the things.
That's fine. I understand because, so many people try to take the high strangeness and complexity of these phenomena plural, please note, and stuff them into a handful of little boxes. Here's the ghost box. Here's the flying saucers from other planets box. And we're not going to talk about all the other weirdness that's associated with it. We live in a very, very strange universe. We try to pretend that that's not true, which is silly.
That's exactly right. That's the one thing in 20 years of doing this, I can say that I confidently have learned that our whole existence is far stranger than we understand. Mm-hmm. And maybe, I know this is a famous quote, I can't remember who said it, but not only is the universe stranger than we understand, it's stranger than we can understand.
And exactly.
I wonder if that's true.
I mean, the human brain, powerful as it is a 6-inch lump of greasy jello, okay? And we're trying to take this tool, which evolved on the African plains for the, intellectually undemanding tasks like finding tasty fruit and avoiding being eaten by leopards. And we're trying to use this to understand a cosmos trillions of light years across. I think we've done a marvelous job with what we have, but there's only so much you can expect from a bunch of balding monkeys.
That's a great point. That's a great point. I love that. Maybe we can only do so much. And then we get into the whole AI thing, but we won't do that now. How much of this do you think might, and again, I know you're not as much into explanations, it's just saying these are the things that happen, but looking at it at the broad sweep, how much of this do you think whatever or whoever is responsible for this, there's a shape-shifting going on where it will present to you what you want or what you expect to see?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that. And there's a lot. There are aspects of that that are very, very weird. For example, many of the classic features of the post-Roswell UFO phenomenon appeared in science fiction in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
before anybody had sighted it out there in the world, people were talking about saucer-shaped spacecraft. People were talking about missing time. People were talking about how car engines would suddenly stop when something, when some strange thing. This was showing up in pulp science fiction in the 1920s, and then in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, it was happening. So what on earth, or not on earth, was going on here? We simply don't know. It's part of the high strangeness of the phenomenon.
A fun story from 1961, Pancakes from Space. Now, some people may or may not be familiar with this one, but this is one of the, whether you believe it or not, it's one of the weirder stories out there.
It is. That's one of the reasons I absolutely had to put the that one in there, the Pancakes from Space. Yeah. So look up the details quickly, as you know, I don't necessarily have all of these things in
mind. That's fine. That's fine. This is a great one, though. Folks, it's worth waiting for, because
this is a great one. 1961. So there we are, in a perfectly ordinary, perfectly ordinary chicken farm in Eagle River, Wisconsin. Okay, not exactly the sort of bustling hotbed of weirdness you'd expect.
Right.
And so a guy named Joe Simonton is out there. You know, he hears a peculiar noise from outside his farm. He goes out to look. There hovering just above the ground is a silvery disc 30 feet across. A hatch opens in it in the classic way. Three occupants climb out. They are roughly five feet tall, dark skin and hair, and they wore garments with turtleneck tops and sort of knit hat-like, helmet-like hats. One of them held up a jug and motioned to Simonton to fill it. He figured it was probably why they wanted water. And he went back and he found that one of the little men appeared to be frying pancakes on a grill. They gave him three of the pancakes. And the hatch closed, the craft took off and zoomed away. One of the pancakes is still is on display these days. There's a photograph in the book. Now, what on earth or off it? What happened there? We don't know. Everybody who interviewed Simonton reported that he clearly believed that it had happened. He was showing no signs of having faked it. He just was baffled by this bizarre phenomenon, and there were these pancakes. One of the pancakes was taken to a U.S. government lab by the Air Force, and we actually got the details of the analysis. How's that for shocking? The Air Force is usually not that sloppy. It contained ordinary earthly ingredients, wheat, buckwheat, soy, and hydrogenated fat, but no salt.
Interesting. It's one of those ones where you kind of think, that had to be a hoax. But on the other hand, I mean, the high strangeness of these things, it almost seems like it reminds me of the tales of the black-eyed kids, where the black-eyed kids will knock on your door and they'll say, could I have some mayonnaise for my hot dog?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. One of the things that makes all these phenomena so strange is the mix of the totally bizarre and the utterly prosaic.
Good point.
And Simonton experience is one of them. I felt it needed to be included in, partly because it's a great story, partly because, you know, Simonton never tried to cash in on it. He never did anything that hoaxers do. He didn't become the center of a UFO cult or anything like that. He just reported that he had this very strange experience and had no idea what to make of it. And that was the last, you know, he handed over the pancakes and away everyone went.
Yeah, that is great. And by the way, folks, I'm going to tell you, and I don't often say this, I literally just added this to my cart on Amazon. I am going to pick this up because I love the kind of idea you have, these synopses of these famous stories. I really like this idea.
Yeah, it seemed to me that it was time to have, because there's a lot of people who have good specialized knowledge of some part of the phenomenon. You get people who are deeply into abductions, and they know the inside and outs of the whole abduction phenomenon, but they don't have a broader context to put them in, or they're really closely researching, some of what's been going on with the Air Force and the Navy, or they're really fixated on this particular sighting, with Roswell. You know, there's an entire community around the whole Roswell thing, but you don't see a lot of attempts to put the whole thing into context. There used to be such things. Yep. Back in the 50s and 60s in particular, there were good books that tried to cover the whole field. I felt it was really time to give people just a general overview. Here are 100 typically weird sightings, 100, you know, just 100, ranging from, wow, there's something flying in the sky there, to, you know, little people come out and hand you pancakes, and beyond. And to give a context, to give the framework, so we can start, you know, wrestling in our hypotheses, either saying, okay, we need to try to explain all of this, or, which seems more sensible to me, not all of these things have the same cause. The world is not that simple. Yeah. And maybe we need to take some of these things as distinct phenomena, but always remembering there are these other things also going on.
One case that I don't think gets nearly enough credit and mm-hmm. attention, and I know there's some efforts, you know, I'm hopeful there's some efforts afoot to bring it more to the fore. And I think, again, it comes down to this very U.S.-centric kind of look at the mm-hmm. phenomena. But I'm talking about the Ariel School Close Encounter from 1994.
Oh,
and,
Lord, yeah.
And then you bring in Dr. John Lear, another legend who doesn't get the attention he deserves. But can you tell people about that? And I'm just amazed at some of the things that the school children did to kind of bring validation to, yeah, this really happened.
Okay, here's the Ariel School. Again, I have to flip through my own book these days.
That's all right.
We're talking Zimbabwe. In South Central Africa, there's a town named Rua, which is a little about 40 miles outside of Harare, the capital city. And it has a large private school. Zimbabwe was an English colony back in the day, and so they picked up the habit of having, you know, these residential boarding schools. Think kind of Hogwarts without the spell. Okay. So the students were outside at mid-morning recess, and there comes a silvery disc, the classic silvery disc, okay? And it lands in an area of brush just outside the school grounds. So here's 62 school children who are obviously very curious. Wouldn't you be? They went to take a look. And some little big-eyed creatures dressed in black, slightly somewhat humanoid, it came out from the disc. A bunch of school children panicked, of course, as one does, but a bunch of them stayed and watched, and they had a number of the, quite a number of the children felt that they had these sudden intrusive thoughts that didn't seem to be from their minds, talking about humanity's abuse of the environment. Okay, then the creatures went back into the disc and the thing flew away. They went back in for the end of recess, told the teachers what they'd seen. The teachers said, oh, well, you quit making up stupid stories like that, of course. And but the children talked to their parents, and word spread, and investigators showed up. And the story checked out. They separated the kids and said, okay, what did you see? And by and large, it was consistent. And it turned out there were also other sightings. You know, it's the usual thing. Sightings typically come in waves. And so there had been things, strange things seen in the sky, all the usual stuff. Now, adding to the complexity is that little black-clad creatures play an important role in the folklore of the Ndebele and Shona peoples, who are the African peoples in that area. And so, once again, we have this weird connection to old legends. What was going on? We don't know. Some kids clearly seem to have seen something very strange. And, you know, but did it involve outer space? Did it involve, as John Keel used to say, not extraterrestrials, but ultra-terrestrials? Are we dealing with something, you know, something from outside our conception of material reality? Good question, but it's a fascinating sighting, and it deserves a great deal of attention.
Yeah,
I mean, I've condensed even from my short thing here. Anybody who wants to get into any of these stories, look them up online. Go hunting for the books. You can go a long way down that rabbit hole.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's a lot to it. There's been full documentaries on it, all kinds mm-hmm. of things, and mm-hmm. I hope to hear more about it because I think it's such a important case that's been long kind of ignored again because it didn't happen in the United States.
Because yeah, we have this America-centric attitude, And yeah, it really helps to get that broader perspective.
So in closing, and we're going to, you know, reiterate where people can get the book and everything and tie into your other work, but do you have a story maybe it's one we've mentioned, maybe it's another one. Do you have a story that's one of your favorites and why?
Of all the things, wow, that's a tough one, because so many fascinating stories. I would say, though, the story that always fascinated me most, partly because I read about it in the early 1970s, was the whole collection of things that went on in and around that part of West Virginia that was chronicled in John Keel's The Mothman Prophecies,
mm-hmm,
Point
mm-hmm.
Pleasant, West Virginia. Mm-hmm. It was a very strange, very complicated combination of things. It came in the middle of this is 1966, so we're in the middle of some of the most complex and the busiest UFO sighting period of all time. And there it was. Weird lights in the sky, men in black showing up to ask strange questions and, you know, prove that they had no idea how to drink water. And, you know, this weird flying creature with glowing eyes that ended up being called Mothman, and the whole thing building up, and suddenly a terrible disaster, which was predicted by some of the contactees and so on. It's an astounding story. Keel told it extremely well in The Mothman Prophecies. And I think the reason it catches my attention, I think, more than any of the others, is that it puts together so many of the different aspects of high strangeness we're dealing with here. It makes it very clear we're not talking about a simple phenomenon. We're talking about something that has many different aspects, many different axes of stuff going on, and that cannot be brushed aside by any simplistic explanation, whether that's the simplistic explanation of the pseudo-skeptics or the simplistic explanations of those who have one and only one answer or one and only one explanation to all of these unusual sightings.
It's true, but boy, do they really try to explain it away. I mean, we saw the recent Wall Street Journal article. There's people out there saying, the Tic Tac video, it's just a Lockheed Martin technology.
Well, keep in mind, one of the principles of limited hangout is that you talk about things that actually happen. I'm fairly sure that the military did exploit the UFO phenomenon to cover up secret technology.
Absolutely.
They did a lot of that. But is that all that was going on?
Exactly.
No, probably, almost certainly not. It's, again, it's complex.
Ding, ding, ding. That's what I say. And that's again, you have people on the believer side that believe everything is like E.T.
It
goes both ways.
It's all got to be, you know, extraterrestrial grace from Zeta Reticuli. Okay. That may be responsible for some.
Right.
It may not be, or it may not. But that's not the whole story. We don't know the whole story.
Right.
As to borrow another bit from John Keel, he had a chapter that was titled, "To Hell with the Answer, What's the Question?"
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, we need to figure out what questions to ask first, and we're not there yet.
Yeah, and to your point, to bring it full circle, do we really have the capability to figure it out? I'm not sure that we do.
We may well not. All we can do is just keep on looking.
Exactly. And a great way to keep looking is this book. I ordered it. I'm sorry, I multitasked a little bit there, but I ordered it while we were doing this. I don't think John will mind. It's the UFO book, A Chronological Journey from Crop Circles to Roswell. Where can people find this book? And also, where can people tie into all of your work?
Okay. This book can be gotten literally from any online bookstore, or better still, go to your favorite full-service bookstore and ask the person at the counter if they don't have it to order a copy, because it's available from all the distributors. And it's by Union Square, which I'm not sure what their status is because they were recently sold, but they were Barnes & Noble's pet publishing house for a while. And so I know Barnes & Noble has them.
Excellent.
In terms of my stuff generally, the best places to go are my blog, ecosophia.net, or my Dreamwidth account. Dreamwidth is, I think, I forget whether it was based on Faceplant or what, but it's a knockoff of one of the more popular online sources, and that's ecosophia.dreamwidth.org, which is where I put. I have not written a lot on UFOs recently, but I covered a lot of strange things. Be prepared to be annoyed. Be prepared to be challenged, to be prepared perhaps to be bored. I mean, not everything I write is to everyone's taste, but I try to keep it interesting.
Well, you've certainly given us an interesting program today. John Michael Greer, thank you for joining us, and all the best with the UFO book.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for tuning in. We appreciate it very much, and we will talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody, and keep your eye to the sky. Bye-bye.